celebrating their 20th year in radio broadcasting with views not heard in the news. The International Taz and Paula Show interviews experts from all walks of life, bridging research and personalized journeys, revealing new ways to unleash life with a passion of a heartbeat. And now, here's Taz and Paula.
Well, you're listening to the Taz and Paula Show, and I'm Paula, and I'm so sorry to say that Taz is not going to be with us today, but she's here in spirit. Well, the state of global politics is pretty disheartening, but a better world is possible if we spend a little more time listening to the messages our hearts are telling us and having the courage to act on it accordingly. Today's guest is the author of the Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All. And I believe in my full heart that this is going to have the power to shake things up for the better. Stephen Dynan has been with the Shift Network forever. I mean, I've been listening and to all the things that the Shift has been doing. And he's been in for years and years leading in organizations, as what I mentioned, the Shift Network, and being a key member of the Transformational Leadership Council and Evolutionary Leaders. Sacred America offers an inspiration path forward with innovative ideas that bridge left and right. It's a wise and beautifully written book that addresses political reforms and the evolution of democracy and breakthrough solutions in realms ranging from climate change to microfinance to peace building. And the foreword was written by one of my favorite authors, Marianne Williamson. She says that Stephen is one of the evolutionary leaders we need most now, which I believe that is so true. And I'm so excited, and I'm so honored, Stephen, to have you with us today.
Paula, what a beautiful, generous introduction. Thank you for the warm welcome.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And I'm going to start this off with a great, big, huge question. What was the purpose of for you to write the book?
Well, I really believe that we are in this time of upgrading, having a larger shift on planet Earth and really a collective awakening to a new way of being. And the only way that that can really happen is on a wide scale is if America goes to the next level. We have a huge influence on not only the economy, but the culture, the technology, everything really that's going on in the world. America, and particularly our political culture, has a huge impact. And so when we have a political system that's essentially going backwards in certain ways and not liberating our full potential and not fulfilling our full highest mission, that's going to be a really big barrier to us making a collective shift to a peaceful and prosperous planet. So I realized this some time ago and started writing more about like how do we achieve a higher octave of what America is here to do. And then I got the inner guidance that it really needed to come out this year, and it's become more and more evident that the reason for that is that we have a level of polarization and almost like the separation into two warring nations between red states and blue states, and the level of vitriol in politics has gotten really quite ugly and to a level of violence. And so what I'm trying to do is really be a kind of a third force, a healing force that's saying, you know what, ultimately we're all on the same team. We're all invested in growing America to the next level. We're all invested in creating a country that really works for the greatest number, that liberates as much of our creativity and ingenuity and ability to create an amazing place as possible. And to do that, it's going to take us unwinding certain of these combat patterns that we're in terms of our political process. So I'm really trying to chart the path towards a sacred way to engage our politics, a respectful way to engage political discourse, and also to point the way towards solutions that really harvest the best from the left and the right to create something that is far more effective.
Well, I think it's time for the silent majority to be heard. I mean, stop being silent. Was it a coincidence, or did you plan it this way, that the book came out just before the presidential election?
Well, I actually wanted it to come out on July 5th for a specific reason, because July 4th we're celebrating our independence as a country, which is an important thing to mark and to note, that we to become a separate self, if you will, it's a mark of our maturation. But to really be a healthy, contributive, noble-minded adult, we have to move into interdependence, where we actually are both building upon our independence, but also recognizing that we're part of a larger whole, and that our role within that needs to be one of service, of building alliances and creating synergy. And so I kind of see July 5th as the natural day of, like, where do we go next as a country? What's the next level of the American dream? What's the next level of beyond independence into interdependence?
Yes, that's true. You know, last month I went to Italy, and the Italians were kind of making fun of our election. So, I mean, they're listening to what's happening to us. I mean, it's a global.
Oh, it's front page news around the world, what's happening in our election, partially because we have such an outsized effect on the rest of the world. So there's a lot of people with a stake in America going to the next level and getting beyond the current problems that are dividing us. So it really is, it's important not just for us, but really for the whole planet, that we do, first of all, take really seriously our duty as citizens and say, you know, it doesn't work for us to sit it out and just sit on the sidelines. We have to bring the greatest depth of wisdom we can, the most heart, the most healing kind of spirit to help bridge the divides that are threatening really to devolve into something that's really quite ugly.
I know a lot of people I talk to are cynical, and they say, why vote, you know? It doesn't count anyway. The politicians don't do what we want them to do anyway, so why even go out and vote? So that has to change.
Well, I would say that voting is a sort of a prerequisite to have an impact in our, because our vote is basically an expression of our consciousness. It's like if we're to want to create more conscious businesses, we vote with our dollars. Every dollar is a vote of what kind of companies that we want to support. Same way with our government, is like not only every vote, but literally every engagement we have with our political process. That could be how we speak about it to our friends and allies. It could be writing a column in a local newspaper. It could be hosting a living room conversation about bridging political divides. And it can be also actually taking the time to do some citizen lobbying with our congressional representatives or local representatives. So the more engaged we are, each of those actions is helping to bump the system in the positive direction. So if we're just cynical and disengaged, basically we're giving somebody else the right to nudge our system in a different direction than we ultimately might want.
Yeah, and what you mentioned, it'd be good to become involved in your local politics. You know, start there, because that's where you can do more change, I would think.
Well, it's ultimately important that we take actions in a way that create some sort of positive impact, because it's empowering to do so, and it doesn't have to be a huge thing. And it can be to go to a local city council meeting. It can be to give a small donation to a local organization that matters. It can be reaching out to a neighbor and saying, hey, let's sit down and get to know each other. It's like these small actions add up. And so what I like to do is, every time that there's a piece of news that I find really destructive or dismaying, I like to take small actions that help to push things in a positive direction. So give an example, like when there's been a terrorist incident and people are shocked and dismayed and really broken down around it, which is heartbreaking. So I will often go to Kiva.org and make an additional micro loan to a developing world entrepreneur in an Islamic country. And that's a little signal from me to somebody else saying, hey, we got your back. We want to see you grow. We want to see you prosper. We don't want to foster increased suspicion or hostility between Islam and the West, which is part of the source of the terrorism, and that's something that we want to minimize, and that we want to sort of say we're in this together. We're one human family. We can live respectfully on this planet. So that's just like a little signal to the universe, but those things do add up.
Well, you talk about in your book, Sacred Citizenship. Is that part of that? I mean, what we're just now mentioning?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I think it's important for those of us on a path of growth and healing and transformation to really recognize that we can't ultimately become our full potential if we live in a dysfunctional society. So we have to take responsibility and say, you know, it's yes, grow ourselves, become more conscious to create our lives as a reflection of the beauty and depth and peace and possibility that we have in our own hearts. But then to actually take responsibility for some portion of our collective shifting in that positive direction as well. And so sacred citizenship is really a concept of saying that taking on our citizenship as a spiritual practice, and it can be from studying up on the issues, and I think it's important that we read things from both the left and the right, and there's a reason for that, because if we just only take in media and opinions that reinforce our opinion, we can get more and more entrenched in one sense of identity, and we can sometimes polarize against the other side. And that polarization is what decreases understanding and increases tension and eventually kind of shuts down the political process. So each of us has a role in creating the bridges where there are currently divides. And that begins in our heart, it begins in what we read, it begins how we educate ourselves, what media we consume. And so as we do that, and then we it's important that we take some form of leadership, and that can be in our living room from creating a house party. For what I'm advocating with the book is to create American Evolution house parties where all are welcome, provided that they're basically acting in a respectful and collaborative way. That it's not we can explore our political differences, and that diversity can be a source of great innovation. And innovation, because it really diversity is the source of newness. And so when we can embrace that diversity of political perspectives and do what I call political cross training and think about issues from different perspectives and really inhabit somebody else's shoes, we're going to come up with better solutions and ultimately be able to talk about things in a way that can get more people aligned and move things forward rather than stay stuck in gridlock.
I know this sounds crazy, but I listen to radio shows that have a complete opposite opinions as I normally do, and I actually do learn from listening to other people's points of views. So.
Well, that's exactly the kind of practice of sacred citizenship I'm talking about. And it's very easy for us to avoid that. I give an example in the book of in 2008 when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential candidate. She was really like nails on a chalkboard for me, and I just found myself really hating her, and which was not typical of me at all. And instead of just rehearsing that, though, I took it upon myself to read both of her books. And so I read both of them, and I began to appreciate different aspects of her upbringing and who she was and hard choices she had made, such as bringing in a Down syndrome baby. There was a way I connected with her on a more of a heart and human level, and that softened the political divide, and I began to just see and respect her as another fellow being who has a right to be here and has a right to her a political opinion, and that it didn't need to be demonizing her. And at the end of that, I wrote an article for Huffington Post called Dissolving the Palin Prejudice, and it ended up being something that, you know, got a lot of fan mail from people on the right, because they felt like I had genuinely sought to understand their worldview and where they were coming from and why they were backing excited supporters of her. And it really opened my eyes to the ways that I was subconsciously, through judgment and marginalizing, not being able to step into somebody else's shoes, and therefore closing myself off to a whole body of people out there who think and believe the way Sarah was believing. And that by rejecting a political leader, oftentimes we reject the people who are supporting that political leader as well. So it has implications on a very practical level, as well as the inner level of by closing our heart to certain people and certain parts, certain subcultures within America, we're ultimately going to end up far more divided and less intelligent about how do we go to the next level, because we want to take everybody's needs into account.
I know I saw the movie about her life, when she, you know, I forget the name of the movie, but it was about her, and it really made my heart go out for her because she really suffered during that campaign.
So. Yeah, no, and that's the human factor as well, is like when we think of political leaders, there's so much hatred and venom and negativity that's trained on political leaders that can be really damaging to your system. And so there's a certain amount of defensiveness that can come up. I see this in Hillary Clinton, for instance. The people that I know who know her say that she's enormously warm and sweet and quite kind and giving with the people around her, very considerate. And yet when she steps into the political sphere, she often has to play it a lot tougher, and she's more defended, and that's partially contributes to where people don't trust her. But that some of that is a reflection of our political culture, which has essentially become a very violent political culture where people are just looking to exploit weakness and attack each other. And so shifting that culture is actually central to liberating America's full potential. And one of the ways I think about it is that we need the culture to come into masculine and feminine balance, because when it's all attack and exploit weakness and essentially high competition, low collaboration, we basically freeze up our full potential, and we don't actually have the transpartisan bridge building that creates real solutions. So I'll give an example of a transpartisan bridge that is very constructive for our society. Van Jones is a prominent progressive leader and CNN commentator, and he's partnered up with Newt Gingrich on something called Cut 50, which is an initiative to reduce prison populations by 50%. So they came together recognizing there was common ground, both from a social justice standpoint on the left as well as fiscal responsibility standpoint on the right, to cut down on the prison populations and to advocate ways to do that as a bipartisan or even transpartisan approach. So these kind of connections have to build from personal connections and reaching across the aisle and beginning first in our own, not taking our own assumptions for granted. And as you're doing, being exposed to different media, being exposed to people thinking a different way, being curious about where people's worldview and values and priorities are coming from. And that gives us a lot more sympathetic way and compassionate way to engage them.
Well, it's like, if you're talking about Hillary, it's almost as though she's afraid to show the feminine part of her personality, because in the political world, you're not supposed to.
Right, and that can be exploited, and so it makes a certain amount of sense. But what we really need ultimately, we need more women to run for office, and we need to have more permission for the men to show their feminine side as well, because when the masculine and feminine are balanced in ourselves, in our society, in our families, in our communities, that's when we really get a sacred sense of wholeness, when there's a deep honoring of this kind of root polarity in the human psyche of the masculine and feminine. And when those things are, when they're in balance rather than at war with each other, we end up with health and happiness and abundance. We end up with loving families. We end up with a real sense of being relaxed as who we are. And so the shifting of the political culture to become more balanced between masculine and feminine, and really the resurgence of the feminine, I see as central to America fulfilling its purpose, which is part of why I put the Statue of Liberty on the front cover of my book, because she's our most prominent symbol of the feminine. And the impulse to bring us your poor, your tired, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It's a very compassionate statement of the kind of mothering impulse of America. And we often, if you think about it, if we think about the government of America, we often think of it as in more of the strong masculine form rather than the kind of nurturing feminine form.
He must have been reading my mind, because that was going to be one of my questions, was how... why you put that on your front cover. So that really answers it. I mean, when you talked about just now, it just gave me chills, because we've forgotten that part of our country.
Yeah. And go ahead.
I was going to say the women in the Congress seem like they're not as bad as the men. I mean, they listen to the other side. I see that in Congress.
Yeah, in fact, there's about 20% representation of women in Congress right now, and when we've had some real stalemates, it's often the women who are or creating the bridges and building the divides. Because, like in the Senate, the women, the Democratic women and the Republican women have a kind of women's caucus and breakfast together and often attend each other's social functions. That's something that used to be more true with the men as well, but that's broken down over time, so there's less and less socializing between left and right. And that really, we really pay a price for that, because when there isn't a social bond of trust, when you get into these heated arguments, it can be really easy to just, you know, progressively demonize more and more and just get more and more entrenched in your opinions. So the women, by creating a little subculture within the Senate where they're more unified in being women and human beings than they are just by their party labels, that actually means that they can help get things done when it's required. And so that's an example of how more women in politics is starting to shift the culture. And as we get closer to 50-50 balance, we're really going to, I think, liberate something very different in our culture. So I'm a big advocate of campaigns and initiatives to bring more women into politics, which can be challenging because it is a hard knock and very aggressive culture right now. And so, you know, a couple of women that I've helped support for running for office is like they can take a lot of hits, and it's quite painful to run for office, and yet it's a noble path to do so in service to the greater good.
I think you wrote somewhere I read that some politicians are more for their party than for the country.
Well, I think that's become ever more evident. You know, I think that it's actually become not something you have to even be secretive about. You know, Mitch McConnell, when Obama first took office, said that their main goal coming up in the Congress was simply to deny Obama a second term. And that so that's essentially saying that, like, trying to advance our party agenda is and to win in this kind of war of parties was more important than serving the constituents of our country. And so we see that commonly now, that it really is, you know, the Supreme Court nomination is another example where
right.
There's a stalling of that, which historically was unthinkable, that this wouldn't happen on either side. But as the battle lines get more and more hardened and there's more and more negative energy between the parties, everything gets interpreted as like whether it's a point to add to the column for one side or the other, and so the interests of party get put before the interests of the people, and that's really what we have to shift.
And I see it shifting in small amounts, but I think your book is going to really help it shift faster. That's why I was excited about your book.
Yeah. Well, I think that what I'm trying to point the way is that it's we have to get beyond just kind of tolerating each other. We have to really take it on as a kind of a spiritual practice to engage in a deeper way with other political positions. And like I gave the example of Sarah Palin, or sometimes in my book talks I talk about my father-in-law, who's a very tough Republican guy, and at first thought I was too much of a kind of, call me more of a new age wimp or something. And I had to prove myself to him. And ultimately I asked him to mentor me in business, and he said, no, you're too much of a wimp. But then I said, well, what would convince you I'm not too much of a wimp? And he said, if you can survive 3 months of mixed martial arts, I'll mentor you in business. And so I did, and actually did mixed martial arts for a while after that. And so he had more respect for the toughness that's required to do business. And there's a way in which the right tends to prioritize strength and toughness, and that more masculine virtues in many ways. And we need that. We don't want that to go away. We want to honor that, but we want it to just be in balance with what would be more feminine virtues of tend to be more collaborative and caring and a bit more sensitive to the impact of how things land with people. And so that there's a way in which when those two things are in balance rather than at war with each other, we end up with a healthy culture. And so we have to learn from and appreciate other political positions and actually grow from them rather than retreat from them and complain about them.
Well, what I thought interesting was the Broadway show Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
It came out now, and I don't know how many leaders went, but I know Obama went to see it and Hillary went to see it. So I think there's a message coming through in subconsciously somewhere.
What do you see that message as?
Maybe to get back to what the founders of our nation wanted, you know, to be patriotic and, you know, to, well, like Hamilton had big visions. And so it's like, it doesn't seem like we have those big visions anymore. And we have so much opportunity to have visions. Like to, anyway, I just thought that was.
I agree with you. And part of what I am explicitly doing in my book, Sacred America, Sacred World, is to paint a vision of possibility of what does America look like on the next level? How do we evolve the American dream beyond materialism to really one in which we are self-actualizing and fulfilling our deepest soul purpose for being here, and we're growing from experiences rather than accumulating more material goods and ultimately undermining the health of the planet. So there's a way in which we paint a picture in which America really works, and that we do have healthy political leadership and a more enlightened system, and that we have reformed our getting money out of politics and reformed our banking system, and we're actually living sustainably and with more renewable energy, and we've created a foundation for real peace in the world. All these things are possible, and if we fail to imagine them, then we're basically stuck doing what we've been doing. We have to imagine a greater possibility. We have to imagine success before we can create it. And so what I'm doing with this book is raising, again, our aspirations as a people to fulfill a high and noble purpose, which I really articulate and see in some of the founding codes, such as E Pluribus Unum, which is our national motto. And it really means far more than just unifying 13 colonies into one nation. E Pluribus Unum is more of it's a spiritual mission to lead towards greater wholes. It's to demonstrate oneness within diversity. And so oneness within diversity is an art form to create, and we have to continue to stretch into that. And right now we're challenged on a number of different fronts, because particularly around political parties, but also the relationship between America and Islam is very strained right now, and that is something that needs to shift. We need to kind of embrace Islam in a much deeper way and to respect the foundations of religion, so that we're working together to help to get rid of and to contain some of the more violent and terror, you know, jihadist kind of sentiment that is undermining the larger good. So that is it's important for us to really find this find the next level expression of the impulse towards greater oneness. And I see that ultimately is happening not just within America, but really on a planetary scale, and that America can choose, and I believe and hope that we will choose, to lead the way by demonstrating more oneness with the world's people and more oneness within our borders and among all the different creeds and religions and cultures that we've accumulated here, which when we're you know, at our best, we really do. But we do have these lingering biases and lingering fears and suspicions that can be flamed and turned into different kinds of racism and polarization.
Well, you talk about the shadow part of our country and that we need to heal that. How would you suggest and how we would heal that?
Well, I think that it starts by, first of all, acknowledging that shadow work is important for our country, because just as with individuals, whatever we keep in the shadows and keep suppressed or keep out of our conscience can come back and bite us in different ways. And so when we haven't done shadow work, we can be more inflated, we can be more full of ourselves, and oftentimes we're compensating for what's in the shadow. We might have a sense of inferiority or a sense of being hurt, and so then we create this more inflated sense of ourselves. So on a national level, we've got a couple of big areas for shadow work, one of which is our original Native American genocide. It's not a small thing that when white settlers came to this land, that there were 14 million to 18 million Native Americans, and only 1 million 100 years later. It's actually a Holocaust of our own that is larger than the Holocaust of the Jews by Hitler. And so it's it's something that we really have to face and work with and actually do deeper kinds of healing with indigenous peoples and a form of kind of reintegrating them into our national culture in a much deeper way than we have, because our reservations are often some of the poorest and most depressed places and really often some of the more hopeless places in our country. And really, I think that Native peoples had a great gift for the white settlers, which is a kind of culture that was much more connected to and reverent of nature, of animals, of plants, of living in a kind of harmonious way with the natural environment, which we really need now. We would need to come back into that more grounded, humble, earthy way of being as a way to balance out some of the excesses that we've developed as a country. There also is a strong emphasis on the good of the tribe over the good of the individual. And so some of our individualism can run amok, and we can get too individualistic and then essentially become narcissistic and self-absorbed. So I think a Native culture has a lot to teach about the good of the tribe in balance with the good of the individual. And so we missed an opportunity to integrate the wisdom stream of Native culture in a deeper way into our national identity. And so there's a lot of things we can do moving forward. You can do things on a very practical level from, you know, economic empowerment programs on reservations. We can do things on the learning level with, like, really learning from Native elders. And we have a Global Indigenous Wisdom Summit every year online, and we've had a number of courses. We can engage in helping to rectify things politically. We've done some fundraisers for an Indigenous Council of the Americas, where Native leaders were assembling from all the Americas to help to advance their rights and their people. And I think that we can do a lot in terms of also healing and reconciliation work. So some of it is just being very open to the idea and being really curious and inquisitive, and then sensing where we're guided to make a positive impact. You know, so that's just one area, and we've chosen to do a number of things with the Shift Network in that direction. With the African American population, it's like there is still a very serious legacy of slavery that hasn't been fully purged from the American psyche, and it flares up with a lot of, you know, the different kind of racial violence and discrimination and the sort of the polarization of police forces against black people in particular has been quite extreme. And so we do have to face that as a country and help to heal the history and to right the wrongs in a way, not because we necessarily in sort of we're to blame. There's a tendency to say, well, we're not to blame. That's our ancestors. But we can instead just frame it as a positive, say, you know, we may not be to blame, but we can take responsibility. We can take responsibility to help to heal, to build the bridges, to really do this deeper work of clearing out this history. You know, the Germans actually have set a great example for us in terms of really taking it seriously as a country to make sure people are educated and aware of and really have faced the shadow side of the German psychology, which manifested in the form of the Holocaust, and because they've really done that shadow work as a people, I think they're far more peaceful and prosperous and clear than they've ever been. That's part of why they're really leading the way with Europe now, is because they've done this deeper shadow work.
Wow, that's wonderful to hear. when you were writing this book, did it just keep growing and growing and growing? It just seems like there's so many subjects that we have to touch.
Yeah, well, that's part of always the challenge. I mean, I probably wrote, you know, at least two or three times as many words as ended up in the book. And so I would write a new chapter or go in a new direction. And then, you know, even in the last stage, I pared out quite a number, because there's a recognition that, you know, we live in an information age where people have shorter attention spans, and having things be more succinct and more focused tends to be better. So I wanted to create more of a manifesto rather than an encyclopedia, and to really just touch on the broad brushstrokes of how we need to face our national shadow, how do we need to reform our our approach to money and finance and conscious capitalism, how to actually build new structures into our government that help us to amplify innovation and innovate more quickly. So I've got this concept in there of solutions councils, where you could have a mayor, you could have a city have a solutions council, or a state, or the White House, that is essentially a group of experts who are going to research what is the real innovation happening in terms of government policy, things that can be replicated in each area, whether that's in the education system or criminal justice system. Frankly, most elected officials are so busy just trying to handle the stuff that's on their desk and the demands in front of them that they don't have time to track what's happening in Cleveland or Topeka or in Finland, for that matter. So they're not necessarily aware of the real innovations that are happening, the social innovations happening around the world. So we need to have more of a mechanism for people to harvest the best of what's happening elsewhere and then bring that innovation into government, which makes it more evolutionary, it makes it more responsive, and it ultimately makes it a lot smarter. Because there's a lot of great stuff happening in the world, and we just need to know about it and replicate it faster, so that our government becomes more effective and smarter rather than larger and less effective, which is part of where the right has legitimate gripe.
Yeah, they don't even have time to read what's in a bill.
Exactly. You know, and part of that is that we've created a system where our legislators have to spend about 4 hours a day fundraising now, which means you don't have time to actually read the legislation, which means it goes to the 25-year-old interns to make a decision on important national matters of policy that affect a lot of people. So we need to have some deep reforms of getting money out of politics as well, so that we can really have the best people, the most noble-minded public servants, to have the time to really think thoughtfully about how do we design policies and programs that truly work for the good of all.
You know, what I see sometimes, and maybe this is a cynical part of me, but I see politicians going in with that in mind. They go in and they want to, you know, do everything for our country, and they're noble, and within a year they change. So that needs to...
Yeah, well, I think that's not cynical. It's just an accurate, clear scene of what's happening. Is that when you have a culture that's gotten dysfunctional, it's very hard for one person to shift that culture, and it actually requires not just the one person in the culture, but it takes those of us on the outside as well to help shift it. So we all have a vested stake in cleaning up the political culture of America, because, yeah, you have some really noble-minded individuals who can just kind of throw their hands up and give up and just surrender to this, well, this is the way it is, and I'm just going to have to navigate. I mean, it's the same reason why in developing world countries that have corruption problems, it's not like their people are intrinsically more corrupt, but once corruption is part of the system, it's part of the socially acceptable norms, then people just do it because, well, why not? I see this other guy's doing it. Why don't I do it too? And so they're asking for bribes and handouts. And so we have to be really vigilant about what becomes acceptable part of a political culture. So we don't have the same level of bribery going on as in the developing world, but there's a form of that with lobbyists and influence because there's a strong need for a lot of money to get reelected. Then there's a slow bending of priorities towards those who have the money that can fund the reelection drives and keep people in power. And so that's a big distortion on our democracy. And it's one our founding fathers would have been very clear that we have to address, and we have to take like serious steps. And I think the level of a constitutional amendment to get the money out of politics is imperative, so that we have people making the best decisions for the greater good rather than the decisions that are going to please the people who can pay for the next election cycle.
Do you see the younger people, like college students and the next generation, seems to me like they're are moving with more heart than the older generation. I don't know if I'm just hoping
well, I think
for that.
That's
what
that's
I think.
Always, there's always a certain measure of truth in that, that it's like that after people can be more, have a more of a sense of possibility when you're young. And then if you've gotten frustrated in your experience, you've had things not work out in different ways, it's easier to close down and become more cynical and jaded and about the ability to change. And so there's a refreshing that happens with every generation of like a new wave of people like, okay, fresh-faced idealism, and we can make this happen. And yes, we oftentimes those visions of the youth are fantastic direction to move towards. And what we have to do is become more patient and more practical about how to make those changes in a way that's very measured, that builds upon the past rather than tries to just revolutionarily overthrow the old. Because that almost always creates a backlash. So you have to kind of say, okay, change on a national level happens fairly slowly. We have to be patient about it. We've got to build towards it. And that's where the wisdom of the elders tends to come in. But we don't want to squash the idealism, because that idealism is what opens our field of vision to a desired future and a potential greatness, a potential new level of greatness of our country. So it's important to fan the flames of that while also helping the next generation better understand the pathways to create change in a step-by-step way.
Well, where I saw that mainly was when Bernie was running for office. He was the oldest, yet he had the youngest supporters.
Which is great, you know, and Bernie in many ways is sort of, I think he's painted a picture of a future America that is important to bring into the real dialogue. It's not that everybody wants to see the same future for many folks. His vision is too socialistic and has too big of a government role to play. But what it's done is it's actually made that the whole exploration of his ideas and the possibility of America evolving into a direction that has more generosity on certain fronts and it made that part of the discourse. It's made it part of something that we can seriously consider, because when you see, wow, there's this many people who can get very excited by the vision that Bernie is painting, that means that, you know, in a democracy, it's like if the population keeps moving in that direction, that is the direction we'll go as America. And I think what will ultimately happen is that he's expanded our sense of the possible America in a more democratic socialist direction. Other people might expand it in a more libertarian direction, as some factions of the Republican Party, they want more freedoms in different ways, from less interference of the government in certain areas of life. And that might be that there's expansions in different directions. And what ultimately gets worked out in the sausage works of government when it works well is that we're compromising. We're finding a balance point between the extremes, and we're finding a middle range in which the greatest number can have the greatest freedom, but also we take care of the greatest number and have fewer people slip through the cracks and really be really on the streets or destitute or broken down, or you know that we don't want to have such the level of breakdown that we have either. We want to have a broader prosperity in which more people are participating.
Now, when you were writing the book, did any new things come into you while you were writing? You go, oh, that's great. I need to put that in the book that you hadn't
absolutely
thought of before.
I mean, for me, like, you know, it sounds a little weird, but for me, writing is more of a process of discovery than telling what I already know. Because I find that the very act of saying, you know, okay, well, I think I need to write something about this area, and then I'll just start writing off the top of my head. And I feel like what happens is there's a higher octave of consciousness, you know, you can think of a soul or higher self, that starts to move through my fingers, and it starts to come through as like, so I find myself sometimes discovering new ideas and potentials, and it forces me to think more deeply, because I'll get it on the page and I'll be like, well, you know, that feels like it's pretty good, but it needs more in this direction. And so the sculpting of ideas in the written form is a is a process of creation and design and growth and discovery. So it's kind of, it's exciting to write, not just to say, okay, well, these are the things I already know, and I'm just going to put them in a nice format for you to hear them. It's like, no, I'm learning and growing through the writing.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, I started the first chapters and had the first concept for it like over 10 years ago. Now, the truth is the last 6 years I've been full throttle creating the Shift Network and growing that into a mid-sized company. So I haven't had a lot of extra time. So there were definitely years in there where I did almost nothing on it. And then there's been some spurts where I'll work on this or that. And then once I got clear a bit over a year ago that it needed to come out this year during the election cycle, then I got more motivated and said, all right, I got to take all these different, the draft and all the different elements and thread them together. And, you know, I probably wrote 50% more and cut another half and cut here and added here. And there's tons of chapters that ended up on the cutting room floor because I just felt like, well, I just didn't have the time to go into it. It wasn't the highest priority. Since, you know, what I'm really talking about is up-leveling the whole operating system of our country. So that means that has a lot of different facets to it. It's not just we need to heal our political discourse. It's like, no, we need to have a different approach to addressing global warming. We have a different approach to peace building, a different approach to how do we deal with banking. And so I would go into different areas, and some areas just ended up, well, you know, there are elements of reforming the our healthcare system that I felt like it was just, I got in a little over my head. I didn't feel like I was adding enough value. And so I was just like, you know what, I'm just going to cut that whole chapter. And I'm going to focus on the things where I really do feel like I can add some value and provoke some new thinking. And I don't expect it. Everybody's going to agree with everything that I've shared there. In fact, the core thesis of the book is that having a diversity of viewpoints is what actually allows evolution to happen faster, provided those diversity of viewpoints can work together effectively. So I welcome and want people to have different ideas than I do and to disagree with my ideas, but I also want that to be generative, so it's more additive. I'll give an example that was helpful just in the final phase. I wanted to have some high-level Republican leaders who endorsed the book, and so I outreached to various people and eventually got connected to Rich Toffel, who's the founder of the Log Cabin Republicans. You know, very thoughtful guy, interesting guy, one of the early proponents of gay marriage, and really has helped to be thinking about how do we evolve a more enlightened Republican Party, which is important. It's not just about enlightened Democrats. It's enlightened Republicans. It's like how do each natural side of the polarity go to the next level. And so I outreached to him, and he really liked a lot of the book, but he had some strong critiques of certain ways that I depicted conservative values and priorities. And so I got him on the phone, and I really listened to him, and I took in his feedback, and I made a bunch of changes. And then he ended up coming around and writing a pretty strong endorsement of the book. So I felt like I learned from that engagement with him, and I wanted the critiques because it basically helped to strengthen my overall thesis and allow it to be heard in a different way by people who are more conservative in their orientation.
Maybe some of our listeners don't know about the Shift Network. Do you want to talk a little bit about that so people can get
connected? Yeah. Well, with the Shift Network, it's at theshiftnetwork.com. We feature a lot of today's brightest lights and teachers. We've had over 1,000 different innovators, pioneers, teachers, you know, authors, people who are creating new paradigms of business, healthcare, peace building. We've featured over 1,000 in our summits. We do about 16 major summits a year. And then we also have about 75 paid programs that really go deeper into personal growth and transformation. And we've got spiritual teachers from different lineages, and we've got peace building trainings and parenting trainings and women's trainings. And so, and a lot of stuff is free. You know, 95% of the people who participate in the Shift Network just participate in free things. And then we've got paid upsells that allow people to go much deeper with a particular area, whether that's enlightened business or shamanism. So we try to balance between it's all, you know, change ourselves and change the world, and in a good way. We try to be very positive and forward-looking and saying what's good that's emerging and how do we amplify that and how do we become better change agents and really fulfill our soul purpose for coming here. So, and we're very ecumenical. We've got people from, you know, we've got people who are teaching about the leading edge of Christianity and Islam and Buddhism and yoga, and you know, we've got the whole range of different kind of perspectives.
Well, I've been on your emailing list since the beginning, and I really enjoy it. Well, I want to tell everybody that's listening, because East West Bookstore is in our neighborhood, and that you're going to be at the East West Bookstore tonight at 7:30 in Mountain View, and talking about your book. And so if people want to call, I would suggest you call the East West Bookstore. It's 650-988-9800. Again, 650-988-9800. Because they have, they can just have so many people. So call ahead and get a ticket.
And thank you so much. Yeah, I look forward to meeting you in person.
Yes, and I talked to you just before our interview started, and we were talking about something you're offering, the launch of your new book. And you want to talk about that, because it's so exciting. I can't believe what you're offering if somebody buys a book.
Yeah. Well, we want to sweeten it, because we want to make a big impact and have a lot of folks. You know, the launch of a book, it brings a lot of awareness and immediate attention. So we've really created a lot of extra bonuses from an American Evolution series with 24 different pioneers, from people like Marianne Williamson and Joan Blades and Greg Braden and Andrew Harvey. So that's going to be happening as a weekly series through the election. We also have the Women on the Edge of Evolution. There's other offerings just for buying a single book that's worth really over $500. And then we've got different levels for people who want to get more engaged and create discussion groups and living room conversations or house parties or even larger events. And then you buy a larger chunk of books to help make that happen, and then we give you a lot of bonuses, you know, many, many thousands of dollars of bonuses. So you can find all the details on that at sacredamerica.net/special, or if you just go to sacredamerica.net, you can link from the homepage too.
So sacredamerica.net. So I would, you know, with everything that that you can get just for buying the book, it's just unbelievable. I would suggest all our listeners to go on sacredamerica.net/special and buy the book and get all these extra goodies.
Great.
Well, we'll see you tonight at East West Bookstore. And do you have any one last message before we leave?
What I think I want to close with is just for each of you who are listening to reconnect with the part of you that truly loves America and has a deep relationship with the mission of creating more oneness in the world and really creating a shining example of what is possible on planet Earth. And so to reconnect with that part, use that as fuel to bring into whatever engagement you feel called to as a citizen, to let go of some of the cynicism and disappointment, and to reconnect with your passion to have America fulfill its true and highest calling. And you have a beautiful role in that, and others will as well. So if you can just build bridges, get engaged, really take on healing our political culture and evolving our democracy as a part of your personal practice of spirituality, of transformation, of engagement, that's how we're really going to create a better America and ultimately a better world.
And I bet from people reading your book, there's going to be a lot of new ideas coming just by reading the book. I mean, a lot of new ideas, new solutions. So it's a very powerful movement that this book is creating.
Indeed, so, that is the goal. So thank you for helping to foster it as well.
We would just want to let everybody know that we've been talking to Stephen Dienen, Dienen. And be sure to go see him at the Mountain View, in Mountain View at the East West Bookstore. And his new book title is Sacred America, Sacred World, Fulfilling Our Mission in Service to All. What a mission. We should all get on board.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy and a pleasure to be with you.
I know, you're so busy, and I just got really excited when I found out you're going to be on our show. So thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you for having me. Have a beautiful day.
Uh-huh. Have a great day, too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Saturdays in the Garage from Advance Auto Parts.
You know, with an older car, you should be using Castrol GTX High Mileage.
All right, car genius. Why is that?
Well, it helps extend the life of your engine, and you can pick up 5 quarts for only $20.99.
You know, a lot for a guy who refilled his wiper fluid with antifreeze.
Hey, even geniuses make mistakes sometimes.
Uh-huh. You know your shirt is on inside out.
Advance Auto Parts. Let's get you back on the road. Also available at participating CarQuest Auto Parts. See store for details.